time for choke points, and drivers in East King County only have a few more weeks to wait before they can get their full highway back. Capacity on Highway 203 has been cut in half since February between Carnation and Duval because of a mudslide, and Chris is here with the latest.
During the heavy February rains, Highway 203 near Stillwater started sinking. The ground under the highway between Carnation and Duval was sliding and settling. The asphalt up top started cracking. The cracking became so bad that the southbound lane had to be closed. Drivers have been dealing with a single lane of alternating traffic ever since. Geotechnical experts put down ground monitors around the location to determine the reason for the settling and what could be done to stop it, but that's when COVID hit, and that monitoring was shut down.
The pandemic led to a statewide halt on construction for most of the spring and the summer, so we weren't able to get out to the site and monitor the devices that we had installed in the roadway until July.
The Washington Department of Transportation's Francis Federisca says they've been analyzing that data ever since. Complicating matters, the state inherited this stretch of Highway 203 from King County, and it didn't have the original blueprints. State engineers didn't know what kind of soil they were dealing with or what kind of history this area has. That also slowed things down. Federisca says they weren't just going to slap a Band-Aid on this problem and call it good. They wanted to come up with a permanent solution.
We don't want to just go put a new road out there. We want a new road, and we want to make sure everything is shored up for the duration.
There is no specific timeline on when the permanent plan will be decided and constructed, but Federisca says the state's getting close.
We're roughly on step number six, debating between two different permanent repair options.
While the state hashes this out, drivers have lost all access to Highway 203 for about 6 or 7 weeks. The road closed Tuesday morning for a temporary fix.
When we closed all lanes of SR 203 to give our contractors a safe space to begin installing drainage not only under the highway, but also on the hillside above.
This temporary fix will restore full access to the highway.
When we have these drainage solutions in place following this closure that is expected to end in mid-January, both lanes of 203 will be open to the traveling public.
You cannot use Highway 203 between Northeast 88th Street and Stillwater Hill Road. That's a closure of about two-thirds of a mile. The detour to get around it is more than 10 miles. Locals can still use the highway up to each side of the closure. All freight traffic is to avoid the corridor altogether.
Sully, I must admit, I've actually never driven this stretch of Highway 203. Is it a popular drive for people out there?
Yeah, it is. It's one of those places, Aaron, that helps you get, say, if you wanted to cut through Snoqualmie and take the long way around to get up to, say, Highway 2, kind of going through the valley there. Lots of farms, lots of recreating to be done out there, plus some, you know, nice home communities as well. So it's, you know, it's popular for the people there who use it, who don't want to go all the way in and, say, use the freeways to get around. It's a big, you know, freight can use it a lot, too, between I-90 and Highway 2 as well. They don't want to go over to the freeways. So, yeah, I mean, it's relatively well used, but, you know, for people who don't travel into East King County, you're right, they may never have heard about it, but it's reasonably popular, yeah.
All right, Sully, thank you for the time. A Seattle charity that teaches kids gardening and cooking quickly adapted during the pandemic to do even more. And Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch explains.
Green Plate Special teaches Seattle area 4th to 8th grade students how food goes from seed to table. They get hands-on lessons.
We teach youth how to grow their own food in our garden. We have a quarter-acre garden.
Board President Gloria Fortune.
Youth get to see directly where their food comes from, actually get their hands in the soil and planting it, from planting it to pulling it out of the soil to cooking it.
Thanks to a kitchen classroom, the pandemic has prompted changes, though, and perhaps an even more important mission. A smaller group of young volunteers now tends the garden, maximizing the amount of produce grown. The kitchen has become a place to distribute that food.
We are actually doing a food bag where this produce and some other things that we're subsidizing in those bags as well are all put together with a recipe.
So the lessons can continue at home. And there's a new one in generosity. Green Plate Special has grown enough food to distribute it to the wider community.
Just in 10 short months in 2020, we have supported over 1,040 individuals through our grocery distribution services and partnerships with other nonprofits, which makes 2020 our most impactful year yet.
Through its core mission and ability to adapt during the pandemic, young participants are learning new skills, community involvement, and a sense of accomplishment. Fortune's daughter among them.
Just the growth that I've seen from her and the other youth that go through this program has just been phenomenal.
Green Plate Special is Cairo Radio's Charity of the Month.
CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy joins us live. And Stephen, I want to begin with a peculiar recording from President Trump. He posted it on social media, said it may be the most important speech he's ever made. It was filled with unsubstantiated claims of widespread voter fraud. What did he say?
Well, what he said was that the election is rigged, that the Supreme Court has to step in, overturn the election, and do what's right for the country. He made no new allegations yesterday. He simply repeated the insinuations that have been rejected by dozens of judges now in dozens of attempts in courts all across the country where the Trump team is trying to really throw as much as they can against the wall to see what sticks, and none of it has. So the president yesterday for 46 minutes essentially made a televised Facebook rant where he just went on and on and on about how this country can't have this kind of election, and that there must be fraud because based on bad faith presumptions in states like Georgia and Michigan and Arizona and all the places where they've made these challenges, the results which show that Joe Biden defeated the president couldn't possibly be what really happened. And he pulled up charts to illustrate how vote totals were reported at certain times, as if that's any kind of proof or even evidence of anything. All it indicates is data as it's coming in. It doesn't indicate that it's wrong one way or the other. And he even made a wild accusation, or repeated a wild accusation, about how the certain election machines used in certain places must have taken votes for the president and switched them to votes for Joe Biden. But there's no proof of any of this. And again, judges, having looked at this evidence carefully, have laughed it out of court.
And it's not just judges, too. I mean, we heard from the U.S. Attorney General William Barr this week saying both the Justice Department and the Department of Homeland Security have found no evidence of any of these claims. And as you mentioned, Stephen, he called on the Supreme Court to, quote, do what's right. Is there any indication the Supreme Court would take up any of these cases?
Well, it's hard to know because at the moment, the president's campaign, as far as I understand it, has not even made a direct appeal to the Supreme Court in a filing yet, despite the fact that the president is publicly talking about that. So I'm not sure that the petition has been laid at the feet of the justices for their consideration. But, you know, we're about 5 days away from that safe harbor deadline you may have heard about, which is based on an 1887 law that says that any challenge that might be raised to the validity of the electoral votes has to be settled by December 8th in a state for Congress, under the law, to give deference to the outcome in that state. If a challenge continues beyond December 8th, well, then the possibility exists for there to be a debate in Congress over whether to accept those electoral votes. And it could be that the president has an interest in dragging this out, dragging the country through this for the next 6 weeks until we're just days before the inauguration. And perhaps he'll turn to his allies in Congress and say, okay, fellas, now it's on you to force the House and Senate to debate this issue. But ultimately, we know that the votes simply aren't there for Donald Trump to overturn the people's choice. So this is just going to continue to, I guess, be out there. One thing you have to look at is the vested interest the president has in two lanes. One is the potential for him to dig out from under some campaign debt that we don't yet understand the full scope of, and the president's campaign has sent more fundraising appeals out in the last several weeks than they sent out in the comparable period of time before the election. And the second lane is whether the president's going to use this fight to launch his new run for office, potentially 4 years from now. He alluded to it this week at the White House at a Christmas party. Behind, in private, he told Republican supporters that we might be seeing him in 4 years. So that could explain the president's motivations for all this. But the bottom line is, you know, the case that's being pursued in court and also before state legislatures is really falling completely flat.
CBS's Stephen Portnoy. Thank you for the time, Stephen.
You bet.
That means it's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness. It's sponsored by your next real estate agent, Mike Novak, and listwithnovak.com. It's being called a miracle at Maltby Cafe in Snohomish County. The beloved diner has been in business for years, but like many restaurants, new restrictions banning indoor dining is forcing the cafe to close its doors. But that has opened doors for kindness to pour in from the community. Locals are donating to help workers at the cafe keep their health benefits.
I got off the phone and bawled because I went, we can make it. There's a chance we can do this.
That's owner Tanya Ballmer. For 36 years, she has run this restaurant and has earned the reputation for helping others. For instance, she's volunteered during Hurricane Katrina by cooking food she donates to support building homes in India. But now, it's time for her to accept the help. She needed $10,000 to support her employees, continue to offer them their health benefits and some pay, a dizzying amount for any small business restricted by state COVID rules. But loyal customers banded together. They started a GoFundMe, which has now, so far, raised more than $24,000.
I'm humbled beyond humble. I can't believe this is happening, and I'm so excited because nobody's going to be out of health insurance for December, January, or February, maybe.
Cairo 7 TV interviewed her in this wonderful moment for her. She says it's an honor to be able to tell her 45 employees it's going to be a good December and beyond.
It truly is a miracle.
And it really is a spot in Snohomish County, that Maltby Cafe. It's a landmark building, a 1937-era schoolhouse. So it's good to see that the support is there for small businesses. Also, I should mention, too, you know, this week, the small business loans from the state opened up. Mm-hmm. And the governor really wants people to tell small business owners who are sort of, you know, they're just being crunched under this stress of trying to keep their businesses open. They may not realize that the enrollment period or the grant application period has started. So let your friends know who own small businesses that there's hope out there.
Thank you, Colleen. 7:39, Sully, what's your traffic headline?
Let me just say also about the Maltby Cafe, if you've never been, find a way to get out there because the cinnamon rolls there are ridiculous. They are about the size of, I would say, a medium pizza. The way they feel like, and they're tall and they're yummy. Yeah, it's worth the drive to the Maltby Cafe for a cinnamon roll. Up here, people in Snoho know exactly where to go when they need to get their diabetes on because they're fabulous.
And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. G Scott joins us. Good morning, G.
Hey, good morning, guys. Good morning.
G, I've been thinking a lot about our conversation we had last week about vaccines and how I know you are still skeptical about them.
Hmm?
The news came out yesterday that former presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama will now all say that they are going to take the vaccine and might even do it publicly, might even do this on TV.
Yeah.
What does that do for your skepticism?
I want to revisit that. I spoke of my skepticism because of the history of vaccinations and everything in the past. Up until last week, it was to the point where I'm like, hey, I'm definitely on board with vaccinations. And then me also understanding sometimes why others might be skeptical of vaccines. And here we are today, and we talked about this last week, and, you know, the best way to do this is for those in leadership positions or, you know, we ask celebrities to endorse shampoo products and everything, and so this would be a great thing. And so when that came out yesterday that the former presidents were going to be vaccinated on live TV for the world to see, I thought that was phenomenal leadership, and I think that's great. I think that I'm ready to see this thing get rolling, and and I'm ready to see those in the beginning on the front lines be able to get it first, whether it's those healthcare workers that are out here doing the Lord's work, is what I say that they do on a daily basis, first responders and all of them, and those, there's a lot of people that really need this vaccinations first, and I'm looking forward to it.
Gee, I think we have to address the history of
Tuskegee syphilis project.
I think we should, because I know there are polls out there that show Black Americans specifically are the most skeptical when it comes to the vaccine. A September survey found 32% of Black adults said they would not, said only 32% said they would get the vaccine, and many of them say that specifically the Tuskegee experiments was part of that reason.
Yes, there's definitely skepticism. I'll even make it personal for you guys. My mom, 77 years old, and last week was the first time that my mom got a flu shot in her entire life. And she got it because her thing, I mean, as she's isolated at home every single day, and some of you probably listening, you probably have loved ones, whether they're at home or in a nursing home or whatever the case might be, it's sometimes like you can think one way, and then you can have a change of heart the next. And I think for my mother, it is about, hey, I want to try to do the right thing going forward with it. And do the best, right? And there's still some that just don't agree. Like, I don't want to get the flu shot, or I don't want to get this vaccination that is coming up. So the answer to your question, AG, is I do believe that, yes, the Black community, there's a bunch of us I know that I've talked to that are skeptical of the vaccination. However, look at the numbers. Look at what these numbers are doing when it comes to COVID and what communities that are being destructed and devastated the most by this virus.
Black Americans are 2.5 times more likely to get the virus. They're twice as likely to die from it.
Mm-hmm. We're taking a risk anytime we do something like this. I mean, yeah. I can admit that whenever my children are injected, although I don't have any beliefs about, you know, the anti-vaxxing beliefs out there, anytime you're putting a foreign substance into your child's body, you worry, you know, because there's always a chance that they could have the side effect that wasn't known or have the side effect that is known. But yeah, I mean, the good outweighs the bad. I think that's what the science tells us. So would it make you feel better if one of us was on camera, G, and we did it on the show?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean,
I'll take it.
Hey, no doubt. I'll take that. And I just want to just say just one more thing. And when I think about vaccination right now, I don't think about it like, okay, this is really going to save my life. And don't get me wrong, I want to live too. But I want to take the vaccine because I am truly thinking about people that are struggling out here, businesses that can't have restaurants, that can't have dine-in, kids not being able to go to school, people losing their jobs throughout the country. So, yeah, I want to get this thing rolling. And is it a risk? I guess it's, they say it's 95%. Yo, give me them odds. I'll take them right now for a better opportunity for all of us to have a better tomorrow.
G. Scott, you can hear him from 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. Thank you for that candid conversation. You really do appreciate it.
You can ring my bell. Ring the bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Sitting in for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Granillo. Joining us now, Rachel Bell. And Rachel, there is apparently new evidence, new research that shows me and my fellow men out there are apparently struggling to keep our friendships alive during the pandemic.
I just have to point out that I like that unintentional pun, fellow men. Get it? Fellows.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So there was this article in the Wall Street Journal called No Game Days, No Bars. The pandemic is forcing some men to realize they need deeper friendships. So I think that we've all been hearing this for years or reading stories about this for years that say that men have different kinds of friendships than women in general. In this story, they open with a guy who has been living alone since the spring. He had a relationship that broke up, so he moved out of his girlfriend's place and was living by himself. And since then, during the pandemic, he says he can go a whole week without speaking to anyone because he's working from home and apparently not doing Zoom meetings. And he's not seeing his friends because the way that him and his friends always hung out was watching football games, going to a bar, and those gathering places obviously are now, you can't gather in those places. And so the whole story is talking about how men are having to adjust and having a harder time adjusting to the pandemic because their friendships are different. So in the piece, they call it shoulder-to-shoulder interactions, saying that men have shoulder-to-shoulder interactions, such as watching football or playing video games, and women have more face-to-face, which means sitting in front of somebody, just having coffee or drinking a glass of wine, going on a walk, just talking. And so men, for the first time, not all men, of course, but according to this article, are having to learn how to do this because a lot of the men, all of the men they interviewed for the piece, said that they never talk about their personal lives with their friends. They just joke around, or they talk about sports, or they talk about video games. And a lot of them are having a hard time. You know, they feel depressed, or, you know, they're worried about losing their job, or they have questions about, you know, their kids and things to help their kids during this time. And so some of them are, for the first time, having these conversations with their friends that women and other men have been having all along.
I miss my friends. I'm going to come out and say it. I moved back to Seattle, so I'm from here, but I moved away for like 13 years. I went to Arizona, made some good friends out there in college, post-college too. I made a lot of good friends. I don't see them anymore. I moved back here almost 2 years ago. I was really just starting to sort of rekindle a lot of my friendships with some old like elementary school and high school friends. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. Over the summer, I was able to like go golfing with them a couple times, but I don't know if I'm comfortable just hitting up my friends and saying, want to talk? I don't know. I fall into the category where I kind of need that social setting. I need to go to the bar. I need to watch a game or, you know, play golf to sort of talk about anything with my guy friends.
Yeah. And in this article, you know, some of the guys say that they kind of feel nervous about doing it because they think that they might get mocked. But the ones that have tried have had good results. Like the guy that I talked about that they spoke of in the article who was living on his own, he said he had some friends come by to help him, you know, set up his computer. And he was afraid they were going to make fun of him because he has this bachelor pad and it doesn't look very great. But instead, it kind of sparked this conversation about his breakup. And he said, you know, for the first time, he told them why him and his girlfriend broke up. It is so hard for me to understand this because I tell my friends everything. Yeah. They tell me everything. It's to the point where I wish that I had more of these kind of relationships like they're saying these stereotypical men have, where I'm like, maybe we don't have to talk about everything all the time and we can just joke around and just like laugh about things and it doesn't have to be a constant report about everybody's lives. Because yeah, we are, it's like 9 months going by and my friends not knowing what happened in my breakup, impossible. Would never happen.
Right. So, okay, what can we do then? I mean, is it a matter of just setting up like online group chats, like, you know, happy hours on Zoom, things like that? I don't know.
I think that instead of, you know, you saying, do you just call someone and say, can I talk? I mean, you don't want to, you don't have to set it up like that. I think that it's just about being brave. And I think it means, I think doing it, you'll be surprised and happy to see that your friends actually do want to talk and know more about you instead of just the surface stuff. So you don't have to say, let's have a talk, but maybe just, you know, call a friend out of the blue or set up a Zoom meeting just to chat about whatever. And you can just sprinkle things in and just, you know, whatever's going on with you. Just like, hey, man, I've been working at home for a long time. It's getting hard for me. I'm sure that you'll hear a lot of reciprocation.
Hey, Sully, what's up, man? How you doing?
Oh, man, you know, I really want to talk to you about my feelings.
Yeah.
No, you know, it's actually, I caught up with my college roommate over the Thanksgiving break just by phone. He lives on the East Coast. We hadn't talked in a while, and it was good. I mean, we just talked about stuff, how his family's doing. You know, those long-term relationships from where we have distance. I mean, I went to school in the Midwest, so I have a lot of guy friends that live way, way far away, and I don't keep track as much as I should, but it was good. That's why I posted over the weekend that talking to an old friend is food for the soul. It was great. I had a really good conversation. So yeah, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
But I'd rather go to a bar and
I'm with you,
throw
man.
A few beers back with a couple of people.
I'm with
that
you.
Would be great.
Whenever we're allowed to, let's do that, Sully. I'm game.
All right.
In the meantime,
when did the COVID restrictions end? According to the government, was that the 14th?
Something like
we
that.
Hope 50.
We hope. Yeah, we'll see about that.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.